Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, who will attend the upcoming White House Middle East peace talks? When will they meet? What will they talk about? Just 1 week ahead of the planned summit in Annapolis, Maryland, all those questions remain unanswered. We're going to try to get some answers in just a moment. But first, a look at a new trend in healthcare. In 2008, more than 3,000 employers, including Home Depot, TIAA, Cref, and Jones Apparel, will offer employees free access to an independent health advocate. And this is according to Business Week magazine. These outside advisors act as a benefits concierge for employees, helping them navigate the daunting and time-consuming maze of insurance companies, doctors groups, hospitals, HMOs, PPOs, deductibles. They cost employers about $2 to $3 per employee, and patients' rights groups worry, will that investment mean the advocates can't truly be independent? Will their allegiance be to the companies and not the workers? Well, Avi Leibowitz and Marty Rosen are independent advocates. Their company, Health Advocate, is reported to be the largest employer-paid advocacy service in the country, and they join us from Philadelphia to learn more about this. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marty, let's start with you. How does this work? Who hires you as an advocate?
Well, typically, Robin, employers hire us, although now as we've grown, we have other plan sponsors, as we call them, unions, in some cases insurance companies and other organizations. But the bulk of our business as it's grown have been employers, large and small, national employers all around the country. They're the ones who pay us as an employee benefit.
Well, if you're hired by the people who hire the employees who have the questions about insurance, you know, how are you not? I mean, many people are familiar with, you know, their own human resources, but in effect, the human resources is paid, you know, by your boss, and so they, you know, they may not always be on your side when it comes to insurance questions. Is there a firewall between you and the company?
This is Avi. It is true that the employer is the person that pays, but they bring Health Advocate to service the needs of their employees into the picture because they recognize that an independent, objective third party that really has no axe to grind to do anything other than get to the right answer will be the most beneficial thing they can do for their employees. So although the employer is paying for it, there's a very definite firewall between the services that we provide and the privacy under which we provide them and the ultimate interface that we create with the employees.
Well, Avi, I want to stay with you for a second, though. What is the incentive for the company? Because we're going to hear some of the things you do for employees, and it includes lobbying for coverage that the insurance company may not say the employee deserves, things like that. We're going to hear about it. But, you know, that is potentially more expensive for the company that's hired you. So what's in it for them to have you as an advocate for their employees?
There are a lot of benefits that the company recognizes. They range from productivity savings, the idea of keeping people at work and productive, to the way that we can make the healthcare system operate more effectively and efficiently and ultimately lower the cost of healthcare. There's so much opportunity to do that. The healthcare system is so complicated for the average person that, yes, they can ultimately muddle their way through, but the consequence of that is duplicate testing, unnecessary services, more doctor visits than you need, sometimes leading you into surgical procedures that you don't need. So when you make the investment in looking at a Health Advocate program, it has lots of paybacks and lots of rewards for the employer as well as the employees.
Just to, you know, add to what Abby said, one of the areas in addition to productivity is medical cost savings. And with double-digit increases year over year, what we've been able to prove and actually provide examples of for employers, and I could give you some examples, are how our intervention helps to save and lower medical costs. And that's a major motivation for employers as well.
Yeah, well, and you can do this because of your backgrounds, which is fascinating. Dr. Leibowitz, you were chief medical officer at Aetna Insurance. The president of your company, Health Advocates, Michael Cardillo, was former president of Aetna. And Marty Rosen, we understand you were head of communications for Aetna. So you all were insiders.
We were.
Give me an example, Abi, of when you might be working on something, some case, And your insider background helps you navigate it.
We do have a lot of familiarity with things that go on inside the health system. And for example, there was the case of a child that needed a cochlear implant. And the insurance company correctly interpreted the benefit to say that they would replace the receiver for his existing cochlear implant because it could be fixed rather than providing him with a new one. But the best opportunity to provide him with hearing more consistently and a more reliable unit was also a lower cost option for the insurance company. And we were able to make the case to the medical directors that really the best thing to do would be to replace this unit rather than simply keep fixing it when it broke. And everybody benefited. So when you look at knowing and understanding what the policy is, you also get the opportunity to know that there are times when you can be reasonable about extending those policies to cover things in the way that they should be covered.
Marty, what's the bulk of your work?
Robin, it's interesting. About 55% of what we do relates to what we call administrative issues. That could be a claims issue, a billing issue, a coverage issue, something that you would typically fall under that category. However, a full 45% relates to what we call medical and clinical issues. And that relates to helping somebody find the doctor, getting an appointment with a hard-to-reach specialist. What we do, given how personalized the service is, we don't just give somebody a phone number and say, you go out and reach that person. We actually, the personal health advocate, makes the call, verifies that the doctor is accepting patients, and makes that appointment. And that's particularly important with a hard-to-reach specialist. Somebody's been diagnosed with a serious medical illness. They've been told they have to wait 4 or 5 months in some cases because the specialist is so busy. What we'll do is marshal the facts to bring to the attention of that doctor, and in some cases, because of the nature of that person's condition, they'll be able to be seen more quickly.
Why would they listen to you and not the prospective patient?
That's a great question, and it kind of relates to your previous question about the insider perspective, and that is that when we present, whether it's to a doctor's office or an insurance company, we're being armed with the facts, we're packaging our request and our presentation in an informed fashion. Most of the time, and I think one of the reasons why so many people need services like ours is they don't articulate properly their issue. So that when you think about going to a specialist, and say that specialist is a cancer specialist, everybody going there has cancer. It's not as if they're going to a primary care physician with multiple different things where you could more easily triage. And I think what we're able to do is not frivolously waste anybody's time, but present to that doctor's office staff and sometimes directly to the doctor because we have clinical people on the phone and presenting the facts to that physician or the physician staff. And I think that makes a big, big difference. And I think the fact is most of the time, every physician wants to do the right thing. And especially if the facts weren't presented to them, they're able to make the adjustment on their schedules to see somebody more quickly if the facts warrant.
Well, what happens if that doctor is full, is not taking new patients?
If it is that our patient needs to be seen and the people there can't see him or her, we ask them who essentially would they refer a patient like this to. You know, if you can't see this patient, who can? And who can see the patient in a timely way and with the level of experience and quality of care that you represent?
But I tell you what I'm hearing is that you have the time to sit on the phone where most people who are working 9 to 5, I mean, some listeners know that I just went through a situation with a very ill elderly mother who was in New York State. I'm here in the Massachusetts area, and the two different Medicaid systems are completely different, and it became a nightmare.
Robin, to that point, one of the basic features of our program, eligibility-wise, is we cover the employee, their spouse, their dependent children, as well as the parents and parent-in-laws of the employee, just for that reason, because we recognized when we started the company that having this what we call extended family coverage was as valuable to solving one of your individual problems or your spouse's problem, no less your parent or parent-in-law's issue as well.
And it's interesting. What happens to us as we go out to employers or other groups and talk about our service is just what happened here on the interview. People tell us why they need what we do. The only people that think the healthcare system is easy are the people that have never used it. It offers the best opportunity for a great outcome. But at the same time, it's enormously fragmented. It's extremely complicated. And when you lay on to that the stress that an individual feels when they're dealing with a serious illness, it becomes impossible. So we by and large, are a support system that individuals are able to depend on to provide them with the assistance that they need, the way that you might look at a lawyer or an accountant for legal matters or when you're doing your taxes. You live with health every single day.
Actually, members of the insurance industry have said, well, why is this necessary? We have advocates. We have people within the insurance company that you have a policy with that you can talk to. Your thoughts on that, because you were both inside an insurance company.
Well, and I have to give you the disclaimer that our largest absolute client for Health Advocate is an insurance company. Blue Cross of Western New York gives us to all their members.
That speaks volumes.
So that's exactly right. When, in fact, we have relationships with Minnesota Blue Cross and Tennessee Blue Cross and several other health plans across the country that recognize that, first of all, it's very hard for the health plan to be your trusted advocate. Although they can do a very good job helping you in the customer service realm or even in the clinical management realm, at some point, individuals come to distrust that relationship. We don't have any vested interest in anything other than helping somebody get to the right answer. I would tell you, and both Marty and I, having worked inside health plans for much more of our life, health plans and the people working there try to do the same, but there's a level of just skepticism on the part of the typical plan member or consumer that the plan isn't really trying to do something that would advantage itself and not look after the best interest of its members.
One of the things we add to the equation is something that the insurance company doesn't do and is not paid to do, and that is that after they determine that, for example, a benefit is not covered under their contract, they probably don't have an obligation to assist the person with getting that service. And we will find other solutions that go beyond their traditional insurance. It could be a government program. It could be a community program. It could be reaching out to a pharmaceutical company for compassionate use of a drug for a special clinical trial. So we'll look for solutions, including even negotiating directly with providers, at least to get the member the discounted rate that the insurance companies pay, that they don't have to pay a list price. So there's all of these additional things that we're doing that really make the value added for the employer and their employees.
Just as an example, we not long ago dealt with a child who his parents' employer's health plan didn't cover hearing aids. It did mean he didn't need it, and it didn't mean they didn't recognize that he would need it, but the plan specifically said that hearing aids aren't covered. We were able to find a Lions Club in his town, and the Lions Club bought a hearing aid for this child. So we do make a lot of use of community kind of resources for people for services that aren't going to be covered by the plan. It's not because the plan isn't doing what it's supposed to do. There are just limits to coverage.
We're talking with Abby Leibowitz and Marty Rosen. They're founders of the company Health Advocate, part of a trend of companies hiring outside advocates to help employees and their families navigate the world of the healthcare industry. But what about privacy issues? Will they keep a patient's medical secrets from a company? And later in the program, will Spaniards go into the future without a king? We'll address that as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're talking today about a growing segment of the healthcare industry, advocates who specialize in healthcare and are being hired by employers to help workers. Health Advocate in Pennsylvania is one such company. Marty Rosen and Dr. Abby Leibowitz are two of the company's founders. They're both former Aetna executives. Abby, a couple of questions about your relationship with the employer. When it comes to mental health, you said there's a firewall. But if someone comes to you and needs help for a mental illness issue or a debilitating illness that's going to maybe, you know, impact them as an employee, do you feel an obligation to the people who've hired you, the employer, to report back on anything?
No. Everybody who comes to Health Advocate completes a release that's HIPAA compliant, that gives us the opportunity to be them in dealing with the healthcare system, but also commits us to respecting the absolute privacy and confidentiality of the information that they provide to us.
And what about if employees are coming to you for coverage for, let's say, alcoholism treatment or other mental health issues or even, you know, dental, things that aren't in the employer plan? Do you turn around and lobby for the employees to have the plan expanded?
No. Our goal is to try to help the individual get the best use out of their benefit, understand what their benefit is, recognize the limitations of it. Where there are limitations and where there are needs that bump up against that, we may be able to help them access other resources to, or even negotiate the price of the services that they need to an amount that they may be able to afford. But we can't get them benefits to which they aren't entitled.
That's Dr. Abhi Leibowitz. He and Marty Rosen have formed a company called Health Advocate, which is based in Pennsylvania, which is hired by employers and unions and others to represent employees in getting through the healthcare thicket. Previously, they were both executives with insurance companies. Abhi, Marty, thanks so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Today, the Israeli government tried to break a deadlock in preparations for next week's peace summit by releasing 441 Palestinian prisoners. And Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said no new Israeli settlements would be started in the West Bank, though construction would still take place in existing settlements. Palestinians said those gestures don't go far enough. Who will attend the upcoming White House Middle East peace summit? When will they meet and what will they talk about? Just 1 week ahead of the planned summit in Annapolis, Maryland, many questions remain unanswered. For the latest, we turn to Gideon Litchfield, Jerusalem correspondent for The Economist magazine. And Gideon, first of all, how significant were today's announcements from Israel?
I think what the announcements tell you is indeed that other things that they were trying to achieve at the summit have not gotten anywhere. And so they are looking to these kinds of gestures to give the summit some remaining significance. The problem was that from the outset, the two sides were very far apart on what they wanted. The Palestinians wanted some kind of declaration at the summit that would pin down the principles of a final state, a solution, the shape of a Palestinian state, and how much land Israel would give up, and so on. And the Israelis wanted to leave all that stuff undefined. And the U.S., which was sponsoring the summit, wanted some clarity, wanted some definition, but it wasn't able to push the two sides together. And so we've now ended up with the two sides arguing over whether how many prisoners will be released and how many measures of those kinds will be taken.
Well, and as we know, there are now three sides in the region, not just the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, but intra-Palestinian conflict between the more militant Hamas in Gaza, which does not recognize Israel's right to exist, and Palestinian President Abbas in the West Bank, who is negotiating with Israel. So is there, how much is that a stumbling block?
Well, that's the reason that Annapolis is happening is because there was this rift that opened up between the West Bank and Gaza. When Hamas was elected to the government, to the Palestinian government, and was in charge of the whole thing, Israel and America wouldn't talk to it. Now that Abbas is in charge of the West Bank and Hamas is in charge of Gaza, the whole idea is talking to Abbas with the idea that if you talk to Abbas and if you build up things in the West Bank whilst at the same time keeping Gaza isolated, then Palestinians will increase their support for Abbas. And so it was very important in this scheme for the Americans, or at least for Condoleezza Rice, to have an output at Annapolis that gave something really concrete, that gave the Palestinians hope that a state was around the corner, because that would make Abbas more popular. And the problem is that this has not happened.
And by the way, why is this meeting taking place in Annapolis, Maryland, and not at the White House or Camp David?
Actually, that's a good question. That has never really been explained. George Bush announced the meeting back in July, and he didn't say where it would happen. And in the last couple of months, the Annapolis location has turned up. I think maybe it's simply because they want somewhere that is close enough to the White House in case something big was announced, but far enough away that didn't make it look like a failure if no big deal was reached.
Well, your magazine recently had a fascinating piece about the smuggling that's taking place from Egypt into Gaza through underground tunnels, the smuggling that's now blossomed out into the open in sight of Israeli military outposts. And we understand it's an effect of the trade blockage that Israel has imposed on Hamas-controlled Gaza. But we just want to just tell us a little bit about some of the items that are being smuggled through.
Well, I mean, first of all, the tunnels have always been there, and they've always been used to smuggle weapons in particular, but also contraband. And what's happening now, as the economy has come under more and more pressure in Gaza, because Israel has been closing the commercial trade in and out of Gaza, is that the tunnels are being used for everything else, and people are digging more and more of them. So you're getting everything coming across, from cigarettes to generic Viagra, from India to weapons to food supplies to medicines, basically anything that people can make money off. What Gaza has proved is that it's very adaptable economically, and it's coping with these trade restrictions in innovative ways.
And it sounds like a sign of, you know, one of the issues that has to be addressed, that this is where, you know, thousands of Palestinians still live and they are not at this negotiating table.
Indeed, and this has been one of the most bitter debates, because the fact that Hamas refuses to talk to Israel on the basis of a permanent final state of solution has meant that Israel and America have refused to talk to Hamas at all. Some people in Israel said, well, we should talk to Hamas because Hamas is offering long-term ceasefire, long-term peace without a long-term final commitment, but that was turned down. And so the result is that basically everyone is kind of pushed the Gaza problem off to the horizon, and they're hoping that in some way Hamas will become weaker.
Gideon Litchfield, Jerusalem correspondent for The Economist, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Back after the news, here and now. What's going on in Spain? Stories of tensions in that country have burbled up in the past few weeks, pushed to the back pages by more pressing news. And this Thursday marks the 32nd anniversary of the ascension of King Juan Carlos to the Spanish throne, so we thought we'd spend a few minutes on the current status of his reign. Juan Carlos presided over a remarkable transition to democracy and an era of economic growth. His is a Catholic country on largely friendly terms with its Muslim population. At the same time, regional tensions have gathered force in provinces like Catalonia, Galicia, and the Basque Country, as well as between Spain and Morocco. This year, for the first time ever, people burned images of the royal family to protest the monarchy, and calls for the king's abdication have come from both right and left. Not to mention, the usually impeccably mannered king told Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, "Why don't you just shut up?" at a summit meeting last week. Lisa Aben, Spain correspondent for Time magazine, joins us from Madrid. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you.
And you wrote in a recent column that the king's outburst might have been because of family tensions. His oldest daughter is separating from her husband, the first separation in the history of the Spanish royals. But it would seem as if he has other headaches. So first of all, let's put this in context. Why is this so jarring? Why is he so popular?
It's quite simple. Against all expectations, Juan Carlos, who was appointed by Franco, by a very authoritarian, even dictatorial ruler, converted Spain into a democracy. Now, he didn't do this single-handedly, but after 40 years of dictatorship, the fact that Spain was able to make this peaceful transition to democracy is quite remarkable, and it has earned him the I think, everlasting appreciation of most of the Spanish population.
And let's remind ourselves, King Carlos followed Franco, who followed the Civil War. And the memories of that era, the war fought by right-wing nationalists with the support of Nazi Germany and fascist Italy against left-wing forces supported by the Soviet Union, are very present in Spain. In fact, they seem to be coming back full force. Parliament recently debated a controversial law about how to remember that era. Remind us some of the issues that were raised during that debate, which was just in October.
The key point about the Spanish transition is that when Franco died, Spain was so uncertain about what was going to happen next and so fearful that a civil war might break out again that they basically agreed to a sort of semi-official pact of silence or forgetting. And for much of the transition period from the dictatorship to full-fledged democracy. No one really talked about what had happened either during the Civil War or in the 40 years afterwards, in the dictatorship afterwards. So there was a general amnesty. There was no call for reparations. The victims of Francoist thugs who might have been either massacred during the Civil War or killed in sort of executions or in prisons, or died in prisons afterwards, none of them were rehabilitated or really even remembered. People just didn't talk about it. And so the thing that made this law of historical memory so controversial is that all of a sudden the government was saying, hey, we do want to talk about it. And there are significant elements of Spanish society, those represented by the opposition Popular Party in particular, who believe that it's best to leave these things alone.
So this debate over this new law and the possibility of reparations, changing school books, we understand that what happened under Franco's regime isn't really even taught in school books. The notion of changing that is still percolating very much in the country.
Yes, that's true. For the whole Francoist period and then afterwards, there was not any real recognition that the Civil War had been started by a military coup against a legally, democratically elected government. There was no recognition that political dissidents, homosexuals, women who wanted to get a job outside the home, all of these groups of people had their rights legally and sometimes violently repressed. And so it's only been in recent times that, yes, in textbooks and that sort of thing, there's been an attention to the other side of the Franco dictatorship, yes.
So this debate is raging. And in the meantime, we are seeing pictures, you know, stone-throwing protests against the monarchy, largely by nationalists in the Catalan region, but going as far as burning pictures of the king and Queen Sofia. So what does that mark for you?
It marks a change in that it does represent the first sort of public demonstration against the monarchy in that sense. But I think it's important to be careful and not generalize too much. There was an initial protest in Catalonia against the king and queen visiting. The crackdown on the people who were involved in those initial photograph burnings was rather severe. They were arrested and tried for injuries against the monarchy. The subsequent protests were mostly in support of those original people who had been arrested. So yes, it absolutely carried anti-monarchical sentiment. Absolutely, it was nationalist, but it was also protesting the treatment of those original protesters.
Again, you see these pictures and you hear that these are firsts. How would you characterize, though, the status of the king, but also of the country?
Well, the king still remains tremendously popular. And I should say that his little outburst against Chavez has only reinforced that. For the most part, Spaniards have been quite supportive and even proud of how he responded to Chavez. But the big question here is what happens next? Juan Carlos will be 70 years old in January, and there's a popular saying that Spaniards aren't monarchists, they're Juan Carlistas. That is, they like their king, they like Juan Carlos, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily want a monarchy forever. Juan Carlos filled a very specific role and behaved quite heroically on a number of occasions during the transition to democracy. But whether Spaniards are going to want to maintain a monarchy once he's gone is really up for debate.
And what does that mean? As symbolic as he may be, is he part of a glue that holds Spain together? Or with his leaving and his son, for instance, replacing him and then perhaps the monarchy disappearing in Spain, does that have something to do with Spain's future?
He's certainly a symbol of central Spain. And at a time when you have these different regions, specifically Catalonia and the Basque Country, but others as well, like Galicia, demanding more autonomy, there can be more resistance to what he represents as a symbol. What will happen when Felipe succeeds him, I think, is really anybody's bet. Felipe himself is well-liked. He is respected. He has avoided all of the kinds of scandals that you see with other royal houses in Europe. But the real question is whether Spain wants to continue as a monarchy.
Lisa Abend is Spain correspondent for Time magazine, speaking to us from Madrid. Lisa, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And here's a quick heads up on some stories we're going to be following later this week. Desertion rates in the Army up 80% since 2003. We'll speak to a soldier who's gone to Canada instead of Iraq. Also, Consumer Reports magazine is out with its investigation into lead contamination. It's not just in toys, it's in dishes and diaper bags. That's later this week. You're listening to Here and Now. Picasso sipped it, Oscar Wilde compared it to a sunset, and Ernest Hemingway wrote, "Got tight last night on absinthe, did knife tricks." Absinthe, known as the green fairy, was thought to drive people crazy, and it's been banned in the U.S. since 1912. But now federal regulators have approved four brands for sale here, and Here Now's Kurt Nikisch has the story.
Until now, most Americans have only known of absinthe and its supposed hallucinogenic effects through literature. Recent movies, such as Moulin Rouge, have perpetuated its mystique, so has the TV crime series CSI.
Apparently, toxic byproducts are released during the distilling process. Stuff is supposed to make you a little crazy.
And how would Angela get a hold of this?
Absinthe is rumored to be served in certain underground clubs.
But clubs don't have to be underground anymore to serve absinthe. At this trendy one in downtown Boston recently, hipsters tried the alcoholic drink for the first time. Adam Stern sampled the traditional way by putting a glass of absinthe on the bar, holding a sugar cube over it, and then dripping ice water over the sugar until the clear liquor turns misty white.
The fable is that, you know, it makes it hallucinate, that's what made Van Gogh go crazy, see like green stuff, you know, you go wild.
The reality is that the 106-proof alcohol distilled from anise, wormwood, and fennel is much subtler, as Christine Bellemare discovered.
It's good. It tastes a lot like every spice in my spice cabinet, yeah. But it's pretty good.
And it's one of those spices that's at the heart of absinthe's contentious history. The herb wormwood contains thujone, a psychoactive chemical that messes with brain receptors. It's rumored to have driven Vincent van Gogh to lop off his ear. For such degenerative effects, the U.S. and most of Europe banned absinthe, but purists always felt it got a bad rap from cheap imitations back then. Purists such as the Swiss producer Peter Karl.
I mean, I've drunk many liters of absinthe in my life, and sometimes I emptied a whole liter bottle. But I never had hallucinations or I cut my ear off or a finger or whatever, you know.
Karl makes Kubler brand absinthe in the same Swiss valley where the spirit was first distilled in the 18th century. A few years ago, he gave a sample to U.S. regulators. To his surprise, they had no problem with it, since the hallucinogen thujone was practically non-existent. Even so, the feds would not allow the spirit to be sold under the name absinthe. But without the name, what's the point? Kubler hired lawyer Robert Lehrman to work the case, which took 4 years of negotiating.
We talked to many other lawyers, you know, FDA lawyers, litigators, that sort of thing. But in the end, we decided to go with the Swiss embassy.
That's right. It took Swiss diplomats, famous for behind-the-scenes brokering of peace deals and easing of Cold War tensions, to convince regulators to put the word absinthe on the bottle, albeit in small letters. But it's just that stigma after a century-long ban that's a marketer's dream, says Patricia Vasconcelos. She's been promoting Kubler for its American distributor.
As marketers, you usually sit in a room for a very long time and you're like, okay, what angle can we do this? Or what story can we develop? What do we have? And this one was so easy.
But some liquor industry observers say the mystique cuts both ways, that some consumers will shy away from what they don't know.
You know, mom and dad didn't really sit down with a tipple of absinthe.
Jeff Kleinman edits Beverage Spectrum magazine. He says absinthe is poised to make a splash since the high-end market is where the liquor industry is really growing, but he expects demand to drop when the novelty wears.
I don't know that there's this massive outcry of people sitting around at tailgates going, oh, God, if only we had some absinthe, we'd really be bashing.
But serving as a niche aperitif or after-dinner drink is just fine with Swiss absinthe maker Peter Karl. He's just happy to have the counterculture drink back on the counter, and he says he can't wait to see how absinthe will evolve as a mixed drink in the 21st century.
There was, in the good old days, there was a famous drink. It was called Death in the Afternoon. It was named after Ernest Hemingway, who drank champagne with absinthe.
Now, Death in the Afternoon could be back after a lifetime of waiting for the sun to rise.
Here now is Kurt Nickisch on the return of absinthe. Coming up, overcoming fear of pie making, here and now. As you complete the checklist for the annual Thanksgiving feast, have you gotten to dessert? You know there's some sort of law that it must include pie. Well, for those for whom the phrase easy as pie never made any sense, we bring you again our segment with Chris Kimball, founder of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and host of the PBS program America's Test Kitchen. Here now is Rachel Gottbaum sought out Chris in search of the perfect pie.
Now, Thanksgiving is probably like a final exam at baking school, right? Because pies are very hard because you have to get the crust crisp. You have to get the filling cooked just right, not overcooked. And most people end up with soggy crust, you know, and the kids just eat out the filling, and then, like my kids used to, and they have this horrible crust. So we're going to start with a pumpkin pie. And the secret with pumpkin pie and pecan pie, they're custard pies because they have dairy and they have eggs, which is custard. You preheat the filling, and you pre-bake for about 20, 25 minutes the pie shell in an oven, a 375 oven. And then you put the warm filling in the hot pie crust, and put it back in the oven to finish for 15 or 20 minutes. And what happens is, that pre-baking means that when you're finished, that crust is going to be really crisp.
I guess what I'm wondering is, what would you tell people to overcome their fear of making their own dough?
Always make sure you've added plenty of water to the dough so it holds together nicely. The other thing is, if for some reason you can't get it to roll out, don't worry about it. Take your hands, put the dough right in the pie plate, use your hands, and smush it in.
Oh, my kind of a thing.
And that's fine. Yeah, that's not
okay.
A problem.
I can handle that.
So you don't want to panic.
Well, right. So we're making your standard
pie pastry, a single crust dough. It has a cup and a quarter flour, a little bit of salt, a little bit of sugar, six tablespoons of butter, mm-hmm. and 4 tablespoons of shortening. And we're going to put a little salt in. A little bit of sugar.
So we're putting salt and
half
sugar.
A teaspoon of tablespoon, a tablespoon of sugar.
And you're mixing in the flour.
What you're going to look for are 2 things. After 7 or 8, 9, 10 pulses, you'll see the mixture, the flour mixture, start to climb the sides of the bowl on the outside. And you'll see it, before we do it, just look inside. It's very white.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So now we're going to do it. It's going to take a slightly darker cast. See, it's already yellower.
Beautiful. It smells good, too.
So now we're going to throw it in a bowl. It's not dry like the flour was. You can, put your finger on. That's right. We're going to cook it.
Let me just put
touch
my...
it.
Oh, yeah. It feels...
Yeah, it's really got a yellow cast.
Yeah.
It feels a little heavier.
Okay. How is it going to become dough?
Most of these recipes now say 2 to 3 tablespoons of water. Okay. 2 to 4. Forget it. Just forget what they say. Take some water, put it in a Pyrex measuring cup, put some ice in so it's nice and cold. I'll start with 2 tablespoons.
Okay. Beautiful.
I feel that.
Mm, I love touching that.
And this will be very easy to roll out. But if you haven't done this too much, definitely put it in the refrigerator for an hour before you do it. Or I'll bake my pies very early Thursday morning, and I will put all the dough made the night before in the refrigerator. And over the evening, it hydrates and it's rested and it's very easy to work with. So an overnight rest refrigerator is a great idea.
Tell me what you're doing here. What's this?
When you pre-bake a crust, you want to put some weight on it so that the crust, it holds its shape while it's cooking. The traditional method is to line it with foil and then put pie weights or pennies. You can use pennies.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an oven bag. You don't have to use aluminum foil.
Mm-hmm.
And these pie weights will help the crust keep its shape while it cooks.
So what are we doing now?
Well, first of all, when you go buy pumpkin, mm-hmm. Libby's is one brand we like, it says 100% pure pumpkin, which is what you want. What you don't want to buy, and Libby's also makes this, is called pumpkin pie mix.
Mm.
That has all the other stuff in it. And what you want to do is control the other stuff that goes in, because usually they're overspiced. We're going to heat this up, and we have our sugar, and we have the spices, and we have milk and heavy cream. And now we have four whole eggs, and we're just going to pulse them.
In a Cuisinart here?
Yeah, in a food processor. In a few minutes, we'll put that into a hot pie crust.
Great.
And in 15, 20 minutes, it'll be done.
Okay, what do we got going here?
This is a deep dish apple pie, which has to be on our table every Thanksgiving. And we use half Macs and half Grannies, because the Macs cook down like applesauce, which helps really to thicken the pie, and the Grannies will keep their shape better. The problem with a lot of apple pies is the filling cooks down. The crust doesn't. So you get this, you slice in the pie, and it looks great, and you open it up, take a piece out, and there's like 3 inches of airplane hangar space between the top of the crust. So we discovered that if you cook the apples with the sugar, we use white sugar and brown sugar and some spices, 15 minutes in a Dutch oven, top on, medium heat, stirring occasionally, and then cool to room temperature, and then we're going to just throw them in a colander, and any excess of juices will come out.
Great.
And then just go ahead and proceed with your pie recipe. And don't use too much cinnamon.
For Thanksgiving, first of all, how many people are you going to have, and what are you going to make in terms of pies?
14 people. We're making pumpkin pie, we're making pecan pie, we're making deep dish apple pie, we're making a trifle.
Trifle?
That's my kids love trifle.
Oh, boy.
And my 16-year-old daughter is quite a good baker, so she'll also be baking something else, probably a cake. We also have a cake for Thanksgiving, which is not traditional at all.
Wow. Well, I'm very excited, so maybe I'll start tasting while we're cutting here. We got a fork. What's that?
Well, we have four pies just for you. We have our regular, you do deserve it. We'll see if you deserve it. We have a pumpkin pie. This is the one we had the partially pre-baked crust, which was hot, and the heated filling, and put that in, and it took about 25 minutes to finish off in the oven.
Great.
We have our deep dish apple pie, where we've pre-cooked the apples about 15 minutes, so that the top crust, when it goes on, doesn't end up 3 inches higher than the apples as they cook down.
Mm-hmm.
We have a pecan pie, which is traditional. If you don't have pecan pie, it's not Thanksgiving.
Okay, this is the...
The world's best pumpkin pie.
The world's best pumpkin pie. The world's best pumpkin pie.
Mm. That's silky.
Mm.
Yeah, there we go. Very tender, wet. It's moist. It doesn't have that overcooked taste. Mm. It's not killing you with all these spices. Mm. It's not just a nutmeg pie or a cinnamon pie.
And this whipped cream with the brandy doesn't hurt either.
Now, you got to talk about the bottom crust.
Mm-hmm.
No. Mm. It's not soggy.
No, the crust
it's
is delicious.
It's crispy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
tell
We've
me
solved
the
problem of the airplane hanger, which
for
is
the deep dish,
which
apple
is
pie.
The crust setting up 2 or 3 inches above the filling.
Wow.
The filling's cut down. You can see that there's still pieces of apple. The grannies are still, have their shape, and the Macs have cooked down.
Try a little of this. Oh,
this
my
is better.
God.
I think apple pies are better cold, actually. But
oh, I'm not complaining. Did you hear me complain?
And now,
okay, what, I mean, I know you love, power tools, but what's going on here?
It turns out that electric knives work great for turkeys, but they work even better for pecan pie.
Mmm! Wow.
I think all we had to do was give you the brandy whipped cream and you would have been fine.
Wow.
Is that right?
Mm. Well, the brandy whipped cream does help my outlook. It does.
This is delicious.
This is... Please, you guys are killing me here. All right, well, we're going to have all these recipes on our website. Thank you very much for getting me a little fatter.
No problem. Is it you taking the fear out of cooking for you now?
I think I could do the pumpkin pie. I'm not that afraid. And you're right about the pecan pie. I mean, you got to have it.
Here and Now's Rachel Godbaum making the perfect pie with Chris Kimball, host of America's Test Kitchen. Again, for pie recipes, as well as recipes and tips for making the rest of the meal, go to our website, here-now.org.
Let's say strawberry, lemon, and lime. What do I care? Blueberry, apple, cherry, pumpkin, and plum. Call me for dinner, honey, I'll be there.
And we want to bid a fond farewell to another producer, Virginia Prescott, a force of nature who's going far while only crossing the border back home to New Hampshire, where she's going to move in front of the microphone. Best of luck to you, Valerie. I mean, Veronica. I mean, Virginia. That's why she prefers V. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.